there's this idea in the parenting world now that, like, we're just supposed to be regulated all the time, and we aren't. No human is. And it's going to ebb and flow, and you're not failing if you're experiencing feelings or reactions to any human around you or anything around you, including your child.
You're listening to the Mindful Mama Podcast, episode number 374. Today, we're talking about helping your child regulate their feelings with Alyssa Blask Campbell. Welcome to the Mindful Mama Podcast. Here, it's about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. At Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have, and when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm your host, Hunter Clark Fields. I help smart, thoughtful parents stay calm so they can have strong, connected relationships with their children. I've been practicing mindfulness for over 20 years. I'm the creator of Mindful Parenting, and I'm the author of the best-selling book, Raising Good Humans, a mindful guide to breaking the cycle of reactive parenting and raising kind, confident kids. Hey, welcome to back to the Mindful Mama Podcast. I am so glad you're here. Listen, if you haven't done so yet, hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any episodes. And if you've ever gotten anything from this podcast, and I know you're going to today, please do me a favor, go over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and review. It just helps the podcast grow. It just takes 30 seconds and it makes such a huge difference. I greatly, greatly appreciate it. In just a moment, I'm going to be sitting down with Alyssa Blask Campbell, the founder and CEO of Seed and Sow, an organization committed to giving parents, teachers, and caregivers the tools to raise emotionally intelligent humans. That's what we want, right? She's an emotional development expert with a master's degree in early education. Alyssa co-created the collaborative emotion processing method with Lauren Staubel and researched it across the United States. She hosts the Voices of Your Village podcast. This is a fascinating episode. You're going to learn so much because we're going to talk about that emotional regulation piece, which is so important. And we talk about how birth to age five is when children form 90% of their brain and the foundation of their emotional intelligence in those years, how it can have an outsized impact on the rest of their development. So we're going to talk about what we should expect for emotional regulation. We're going to talk about how we're not supposed to be regulated all the time, and our kids aren't either. And the phases of emotional processing. This is going to be such a valuable episode. I know you are going to love it. So let's dive in with Alyssa Blask Campbell.
Are you struggling with kids fighting, yelling, and more despite listening to the podcast and reading all the books? Parenting can be so overwhelming and exhausting. You know, I see you and I have something that will help. Mindful Parenting SOS. I'm offering free, live, mindful parenting sessions starting Monday, May 6th. Basically, live mindful parenting lessons that you'd normally have to pay for. So if you struggle with getting your kids to listen, tantrums, misbehavior, and feeling the guilt of yelling at your kid, then you should definitely get your spot in Mindful Parenting SOS. I'll be there to answer your questions in person, and if you can't make it, we will have replays available. Don't wait to get your spot now. It's free. Go to mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS to register. That's mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS. I can't wait to see you there.
I love what you're doing with Seed and Sow. I love the, you know, all of these tools for emotional development and helping people understand kids' emotional development more logically. I feel like we're like almost like handicapped in our culture by this, like these ideas that we have that like kids have a lot more emotional control than they actually do have. And so we don't realize that I was just saying, you know, kids are just naturally, like, they're messy, they're aggressive, they're, like, wild and crazy, they can't control their feelings, like, they can't control their actions that well, they can't control their feelings that well. They kind of go from, like, babies where we're, like, oh, we have to do everything to them, and then suddenly they're toddlers, and we're, like, you should be able to get it together, kid. What's wrong with you? I mean, do you see that as kind of like the overarching idea that we have, like at least in the US, as far as the way we look at kids?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was interesting. So I co-created this collaborative emotion processing method, researched it with a colleague, and we have a book coming out on it next year. And it, when we were doing the research, one of the things that was so interesting was that the approach to infants and toddlers was almost like very low expectations.
Yeah.
We don't expect them to have a lot of these skills, and almost to the point where, like, we should expect a little more. They do understand more than we give them credit for, and they can build more skills earlier than we often give them credit for. But then they hit a certain age, and for a lot of people, we've noticed it's about 3, mm-hmm. where we want them to have these skills now. And we didn't teach them to them, but we just expect that by the time you're 3, now you'll have all of these social skills and empathy skills and regulation skills and all that jazz that we may not have laid the foundation for them to have. But like almost like too high of expectations for 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds beyond, and too low earlier. And, you know, you were saying that we expect kids to have like certain level of self-control often that they don't have. And it's so interesting because when we pause and think, and I'll ask parents, like, what happens for you when you're angry? Like, what, how do you express when you're angry? So that we're not just telling kids what they can't do, but that we start to talk about what they can do and model that, and et cetera. And how many of us aren't doing this in our everyday life, but then expect it of a kid?
Yes. Exactamundo. No kidding. Yeah, I know. We can't. Yeah, we almost like, I mean, it's so crazy. Like, we're like, you will control your feelings so that I feel better, you know, and yep. I don't lose in my cool, right? Like, it's just such a backwards way of doing it, because we're the ones with the fully developed prefrontal cortex, which is like the inhibitory part of our brain, right? Like, they have like much less a chance, but that is the kind of, we don't realize it, but that is kind of the message that we send
so often. Yeah. And we say a lot at Seed that it's not a child's job to get calm for us, it's our job to get calm for them. And if we feel like we don't have the tools to get calm for them in the moment, we definitely can't expect them to get calm for us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm so with you on all of that. So we're here to talk about like 0 to 5 little kids, some of the things we should expect developmentally from little kids, some of the ways we can support, you know, little kids. I'll just call them little kids because I think that's better and funner than saying 0 to 5. But I'm curious about you. So you have a 14-month-old, but you've been studying this and for years. What made you so fascinated in little kids? Like, were you like, can I make like an armchair guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this will be fun. Okay. So if I had to tell the story about what it was, I would maybe think like, maybe like you were like an oldest child who had to like maybe take care of younger children in a family situation and got really fascinated by it. I'm totally way off.
Tell Hunter, this is so fun. I love this. No, keep it going.
Maybe my guess is like you are not an only child. Anyway,
I am not an only child.
Okay,
that is correct.
Good. I got one thing.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to keep guessing? Because no, I'm no. loving this.
No. Tell me the truth.
Okay.
Before I dig myself in too far.
I am 1 of 5, but I'm number 4 of 5. So I have 3 older brothers, 1 younger brother. I grew up in the village, like. It, truly, like in the village.
Like
I grew up
the village
in a small
in New
farm
York
town.
City? Oh, no.
No,
okay,
like the village in the
okay.
sense of like it takes a village to raise
yeah,
kids,
yeah. Okay,
and everyone
good.
Now we're like, okay, but where's that village? I really grew up in the village in that sense. It was a small farm town in western New York and a low income town, and everybody really like pitched in to do life. And I got my corn from Allie Ty's farm down the road. Like, I started watching people's kids. My mom ran a home daycare that was, like, unlicensed, unregulated, basically to be a stay-at-home mom. She watched other people's kids. And so as long as I can remember, there were a million kids around. And I would come home from school to kids. And I remember being, like, in probably 4th grade and came home on a half day of school, and my mom had kids there that she was watching, and there was this baby, and I picked him up and was talking to him, like holding him above my head, and I didn't know he just had a bottle, spit up into my mouth.
Ew!
Yeah, but like this is just like, and I was in like fourth grade, right? And like these are it's just been my life. Like I've been around kids my whole life. There's not a picture of me as a child above the age of like 3 where I'm not carrying another child around. To the point where I'm like, maybe somebody should have been like, you're 5 and that's a newborn and I'm nervous. But yeah, no,
you're
it's
like,
just
now
truly...
that I know what I know about 5-year-olds.
Like, should I be carrying that newborn? It's just truly been always a part of my life, being in a big family, but more so just being in a community where everyone really pitched in. I was 12 when I started babysitting, and like by 16 was like driving 3 kids in my car, and like always had a car seat that was in my car, and yeah, it's just really been in my life always. Mm-hmm. And went to college and got a nanny job while I was at college. I can't, just the idea of not being around young kids doesn't make sense to me.
That's amazing. Yeah. It almost sounds like what you're describing is almost like, you know, I was talking to Michaeline Duclef about I think it's the Harari people, and they're like a hunter-gatherer tribe in, I forget what part of the continent of Africa was, but like, yeah, like little kids, like small kids are carrying babies and everybody's pitching in, you know, and that is... And it's so interesting to think about, because we have this idea of, you know, like that we should be able to do everything on our own and all of this thing. And that is not how humans evolved to be. You know, we we're born so premature compared to every other animal species. We're born so helpless. Like the only possible way it was possible for us to like raise these helpless children that needed so many hours and hours and years of care was if there were a lot of people around helping do it, right? And so no wonder we feel like we're failing when we're all by ourselves.
Yeah, we're not meant to do all of this by ourselves. Even like most of it.
Yeah.
I truly just like was raised in that village sense, and have been around kids forever, and then also had my own journey with emotional development specifically. And as my journey with emotional development was unfolding, I experienced some trauma as a teen, and then like navigating that aftermath and what did that look like for years to come and how did it show up in my life? And what was the difference between that and other hard experiences that I'd had? And like as I started to uncover all of that in late teens, early 20s in therapy, realized like so much of what I was doing was part of the foundations in early childhood that I was teaching at the time in early childhood, and my master's is in early ed, and realized like, oh, these are all things that I'm now doing with kids that I didn't get as a kid growing up. That like there were parts of this, we've evolved so much in our research around emotional development has changed vastly in the last 20 to 30 years. We know so much more, in the same way that like the car seat that I was in as a child is not the car seat that my child is now in 30 mm-hmm. some years later. Like that has evolved, thank goodness, because I don't know if you have any childhood pictures, but it's like basically a bucket with a strap.
It's a bucket, yeah.
And right, like it is a little rough looking, like I'm glad I made it, but that has evolved, and so should our emotional development. So should the way that we are looking at how kids learn and grow and develop, and our research has evolved, and so now our practices are evolving. All that to say that like my parents did the best they could with what they have, and now I have a set of tools through my education that I was learning, and I was like, oh, this is different than what I grew up with, and just started to kind of make that connection.
I want to tell you about a great podcast that you should check out, especially if you ever deal with any school system, which you probably do. It's called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ortubé, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. And this season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP and busts common myths about special education. So I checked out the episode on the difference between IEPs and 504 plans because my daughter Maggie uses a 504 plan, and it was really, really helpful. It went over all the differences, which one's better, how to get them, different myths and what your rights are, all kinds of different things that you should understand if your child may need extra help in education through an IEP or a 504 plan. The tone is super helpful, friendly, and smart. I highly recommend you check it out. To listen to Understood Explains, just search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's it. Understood Explains. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. So it's been crazy here in Delaware. Everything is blooming. It is so beautiful. But man, my allergies, it's throwing off the whole learning. And sometimes I sound really different. You might even hear it. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray, and it delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. I used Astapro before I went for my run this morning, and I could breathe so well. It helped me enormously. No more itchy, no more drippy. It was great. Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
So what did you see, like, when you were doing this research and stuff that you didn't get as a kid? And this is, of course, not to knock your parents, because we don't, you know, they were in a different time and they don't know these things, and they were carrying on what people had done before. So what, but what did you not get as a kid that you discovered that kids need?
Yeah, so I have incredible parents, as and they're so far from perfect, right? Like all of us as humans. And I'm super grateful for them, as like a caveat. And yes, I didn't grow up in what we would call a secure attachment relationship. I grew up in a household where there were terms like dramatic or emotional were applied when I was having a hard emotion. And I was allowed to have it, but I was expected to have it like in my room, and then I could come on out and we could talk about what we were going to do next.
Ditto. Too sensitive. That was me.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And so I was allowed to have them. It just wasn't something they were going to be privy to or around. They were ready to talk about the problem solving, the conflict resolution part when I was ready for that. And I could take my time having a hard emotion. I just was going to do it in my bedroom. Or I was going to be removed to the car if we were at like a public thing or et cetera. And there was no discussion around coping for processing experiences. Because they weren't a part of the emotional expression, they were there for the problem solving, the conflict resolution. I developed, so when we're part of our method, it involves the phases of emotion processing, and there are five of them. And the very last one is problem solving or conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And the first four are about connecting with the child and helping them feel safe and seen, which then allows their nervous system to calm so that they can access problem solving, conflict res, empathy, etc. And in those first four phases, my parents, number one was allow. They would allow me to have it, so they did that one. Number two is the recognition of the perceived emotion. So this would be like
acknowledging
the emotion that they're having, or that we think that they're having, like, oh, you were working so hard on that and it crashed. It's so frustrating. Just validating and connecting over that experience and what they're experiencing. So I didn't necessarily have that part. Mm-hmm. And then security in the feelings, recognizing that it's okay and safe to feel this because it won't last forever. that all feelings are temporary. And this is where we see anxiety. When we don't have security in our feelings, we are often trying to run or to-do list our way out of it or make it go away as fast as possible. And then it really is just like quicksand where you just get deeper and deeper. It digs a hole there. And then the fourth phase is coping. And there are two different types of coping. We have coping mechanisms and coping strategies. And coping mechanisms are what we will automatically develop and turn to make it stop as fast as possible. It's what our body's designed to do to make it stop, to have temporary relief, often turning to something that's going to elicit dopamine, that reward center of our brain.
Chocolate.
So now it might... Chocolate. Yeah, chocolate's a great one. Chocolate food in general, but chocolate has a decent amount of dopamine. So if you're looking for a dopamine hit, it's a great turn. Screens, distraction, ignoring it, like just trying to distract yourself and move on. My biggest dopamine hitter is shopping. I can fill a cart like it's nobody's business. I don't even have to check out. I could just fill that cart like there's no tomorrow. For some folks, it could be substance abuse or use. And anyway, so as a kid, it's often distractions, our biggest one that we turn to, or screens, where we will try and just like distract them out of it, or use a screen to get that dopamine. And then coping strategies are going to produce serotonin or oxytocin. So oxytocin being that like love, feel good hormone, serotonin calming the nervous system. And these, you'll often feel that emotion, or you'll have the experience, the nervous system experience, for a little bit longer. Dopamine has a faster reaction. So like you can numb it pretty quickly with dopamine, or the coping mechanism, versus the coping strategy might take a minute longer. You might be in that feeling and then you start to feel some relief. So this could be taking deep breaths. It can be moving your body with young kids. It can be like doing big jumps or jumping into a pillow pile, or I'll do like a race with kids sometimes, like, oh, I'm not ready to figure this out yet. Let's see how many frog jumps it takes us to get to the bathroom door and back. I bet we can do it in 10. What do you think? And then we're going to move our bodies and move that cortisol or adrenaline, and then once we're calm, then we move on to that like problem solving, conflict resolution, etc. And the other form of moving your body would be vestibular input, which is that like swinging, going upside down, moving the plane of your head. So big body, moving the plane of your head, or like taking deep breaths, having some sensory deprivation or down regulation, removing yourself,
my toes.
Having quiet.
I never.
Nice.
I always touch my toes. It's like never thought of it as like a vestibular thing, but like I always think of it kind of like, sort of in the, I guess the yoga terms of like a folding forward is like a calming method. You know, like it's like, and it, I just, to me it feels like a release, like stuff falling out of my head.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's a great one. That's a great one. Yeah, and so as a kid, I wasn't given coping strategies. I wasn't told, like, here are things you can do to calm your nervous system so that we can talk about problem solving. It was just like, yeah, go, and when you're ready, here's where I'll be.
I don't think any of us were. Like, it's generationally, like, none of us were. And, you know, we still have some major people, like, on TV who are saying, kid, go by yourself and just calm down, like without any strategies, right? It's like, it's frustrating to see.
So frustrating. And yeah, I guess like it's triggering for me because I'm like, no, I know what that looks like down the road. And you have to build all these tools as an adult. And you end up just numbing through emotions in your teens, Alyssa. And so like, as I was doing that work on myself and realizing those things, I was like, oh, like, this is what that is. Like, this is how this plays out down the road. These are different ways it shows up. And I was just talking to a friend the other day, and was saying that I so often, when I like see adults or older kids, teens, et cetera, and adolescents, I can see them as a 2-year-old. Like I know, I'm like, oh, I know what that looks like, that habit or that pattern. I know how that shows up in infancy and toddlerhood and preschool. And it's so interesting, like now seeing like even my own habits, I'm like, yep. And I know what that looks like when they are young. I was just consulting with a teacher the other day who's been in the field for 30 years in early childhood, and she was asking about this. We have a professional development program for teachers. We support teachers with this work. And she was asking about a kid in her class. She was like, I've just never seen this profile before. Like, this is so new. And the kid's like 3 or 4 right now. And I was like, is this how it showed up in infancy and in toddlerhood, et cetera? Did you see these behaviors? And she was like, nail on the head. Just so clear to me of like, oh, that, because it's the same root. They just show up in different ways down the road when you don't have these tools.
It's so fascinating. And I'm sure you can see, I mean, as I can see, like, as you look into, like, I mean, I look into, like, a lot of the problems in the world, right? And I look at all the challenges. I look at the leaders who have issues and all of these things. And I think of all of these challenges with, like, aggressive responses and anger and all of these things. And I think these are all people who just don't know how to process their feelings. Like, and they weren't taught how to process a feeling like frustration or anger. And it's this acting out on this thing. And it's really, I feel like the lack of being able to process and understand and take care of our feelings is basically at the root of like almost everything. I look at that, I'm like, or conflict resolution too. But anyway, but being able to process feelings generally is at the root of everything. I'm sure you totally see that as you look into the world.
All the time. It's like a joke in my household where like anytime something happens, I'm like, oh, I wish I had them as a toddler. Like I wish I could have worked with them as a
young
kid.
Is important. Like you're talking about toddlers. This is important because the ages 0 to 5 are really important for kids, right? Like this, tell us about, I mean, because, and I feel a little funny about bringing this up because sometimes I felt like, or especially as a parent, especially when I was an unskillful parent of like a 0 to 3-year-old, I felt like, oh my God, it's so much pressure to put on people who are brand new to this job. Your life has been turned upside down. You're like healing physically. Everything's different. The world is upside down. And you have the responsibility of somebody's future, like mental health in your hands. It's like, oh my God, it's like so much pressure. But at the same time, so we should understand, like, as we go into this conversation, I guess, so for you, dear listener, parent of a small child, that we're going to talk about that, how this is an important time. And I want you to know that that the brain is plastic and kids grow and change and learn all the time. Adults grow and change and learn. Nothing is set in stone. So that's my caveat to this conversation, because we get so paralyzed by anxiety to be doing it right that it leads us to be unskillful because we're so like anxious about things, you know? Totally. So, but with that said, tell us about how important 0 to 5 is.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, it's wicked important. And I've never,
I love that.
I heard it come out of my mouth too.
No, it's so great because I grew up in Rhode Island and now I live in Delaware and no one says anything is wicked anything anymore. And they all look at me. If I ask for a bubbler, no one knows what I'm talking about. And to say something is wicked important, I'm just like, you've made my day, Alyssa. You have no idea.
Hunter, I'm glad I could give you that gift. I heard it come out of my mouth and I was like, oh, that's gonna make me like in a certain region. I do live in Vermont. It is wicked important. And I've never left a single day as a parent, as a teacher, as a human with a master's in this and who's done research in it and been in it for so long. I've never left a day and been like, I was perfect today. It's not real and it's not the goal. And as long as that is our goal, we are going to feel like we're failing each day. So to start there, that there is no perfection. No. And it doesn't have to be. Like, it's not like, oh, well, that is really the goal. We're just not reaching it. No, it truly doesn't have to be the goal. It's not my goal for the days. In fact, if I was, quote, perfect each day, for me, perfection would look like I am feeling triggered by things. I'm feeling hard feelings and I'm acknowledging them and I'm tapping into tools to show my child that it's not their job to get calm for me, that I will get calm and be a leader here, and that I do have feelings and I experience feelings and I lose my cool sometimes, and I'm going to own that responsibility. so that then I can show up for them. It doesn't mean that they do something super annoying or triggering and I'm just like, oh yeah, I don't have a feeling about that. So just as a starter for folks tuning in, I think there's this idea in the parenting world now that like we're just supposed to be regulated all the time, and we aren't. No human is. And it's going to ebb and flow, and you're not failing if you're experiencing feelings or reactions to any human around you or anything around you, including your child. So that little disclaimer. It is important because we form 90% of the brain in the first 5 years, 80% of that in the first three. And what we mean by that is that, you know how when like a baby comes out a year later, if you look in like a time hop photos of like that child a year ago, or you go from like one to two, you're like, wow, it's a vastly different child with hugely different skill sets. Like when this child was born, they could do almost nothing. They couldn't move their body. If they were left by themselves, they would die. And then by one, they, for the most part, can move around a little bit. They can eat some food. They're starting to talk and communicate in different ways. Like, and then we just continue to see that progression of like skills. Like, if I think of the things that I gained in the last year, the new skills that I built, it's like not even close to the new skills that my child built in the last year.
Yeah.
In terms of how different our skill set is a year later. So the brain is learning so much. It's taking in this whole world and learning all these different skills for how to move their bodies, how to function in the world, how to stay alive in the world, how to communicate, how to eat, what it looks like to, like move, like basic functions are happening. And then we, when we're looking at like sending a kid off to kindergarten, if your kid goes to school at five, we're saying a lot of those foundations for existing in the world have been formed. And now we're going to work on fine-tuning those systems and adding content and things like your ABCs or your name or your colors or shapes or whatever. It's why, like, I don't care at all if a child knows those things in these early years, because they can absorb any content that comes their way if they have all these other foundational skills for how to move through the world first. And so what we are looking at when we're looking at that 90%, I want to help make sure that their motor development is going to serve them, that they can move their bodies in a way that is helpful for their nervous system, and that will be helpful for them to navigate the world. I want to make sure that their language and communication skills are going to serve them so that they know how to ask for what they need, that they know how to enter into a social group, that they know how to advocate for themselves in different scenarios. I am looking at their nervous system regulation is my most important, probably, of like what is happening in my body. You were talking about adults not having these tools for emotion processing, and I would even go one step back and say that so many adults don't have tools to recognize what's happening in their body, that until they're exploding and then looking back on, right? Like reflective practice is a great tool. And what we want to start to build is what is happening in my body when it's happening or when it's building, or I just felt that rush of cortisol or adrenaline. Where do I feel it in my body? How does that show up? And in when we're working with kids in this, we have kids who can start to notice this when we're consistently working with them in toddlerhood, where they can squeeze their fists and let them go because we've acknowledged like, oh, I see that you're frustrated. Your hands are so tight and your shoulders are up to your ears and your voice is getting so loud. Gosh, you sound frustrated. I'm going to squeeze my fists with you and let them go and bring my shoulders up to my ears and let them go. And like helping them build that body awareness of what's happening in my body. And then the tools for how do I regulate it? How do I calm it? When we are sending kids into kindergarten, they can have a lot of tools for self-control, but the foundations for self-control are self-regulation and self-awareness. You can't regulate what you're not aware of, and you can't be in control of a body that's dysregulated. And so what we're focused on with emotion processing and emotional regulation is first going to start with that nervous system regulation. And it really, really just begins. So when parents are tuning in, if they're like, where do I start? Start by acknowledging what you see happening in their bodies, whether they are an infant, a toddler, a 3-year-old, a 13-year-old, showing them what's happening in their body starts by us acknowledging that and helping them start to tune into, like, oh, in the same way that if we said you have butterflies in your stomach, we know, oh, that feeling, and you know, I'm feeling nervous or excited, starting to help them build language around what that looks like for different emotions. What does it feel like in your body when you feel frustrated, or when you feel embarrassed, or when you feel sad or disappointed or excited or happy or left out? How does that feel in your body? And starting to help them tune into that. That's what I'm looking at in that 90% early years component.
Yeah, because if we can do that, we can have the awareness. It's really is the foundation of everything. And it's so mind-boggling to think about this, because it was something that we were completely blocked from talking about for at least in the Western culture that, you know, led to the United States millennia, I'm sure, you know, and it's so essential. It's interesting. It's like, I feel like this, our sort of emphasis on sort of like our mind states and our, you know, the stories that are in our head and cognition has led to this kind of blocking of this understanding of being in our body, that we are an embodied people, and that blocking has led to just so many problems and all of these things that we have to relearn as adults. I mean, that's what we work on all the time in mindful parenting, is like being aware of the sensations in our body, being aware of our feelings, acknowledging our feelings, right? Doing all of these things so that if we can do it in ourselves as parents, then we can also do it for our kids. And that modeling of just, you know, I'm feeling X right now. I mean, it's interesting as we talk about it, because it sounds to me at this point in my life like so simple, but it's something that just has not been embedded in the culture that we are. I mean, I guess you and I, like, and many people are working on bringing back into the culture, but it's still not terribly mainstream yet. It's so fascinating.
We are supported by Cozy Earth bedding products that will transform your sleep. I mean, I know, like, we get some sleep deprivation sometimes as parents. There is a study, did you know about the study, that found that 7 in 10 parents get an average of 3 hours of sleep a night in the baby's first year? That's crazy. Parents, we deserve to have quality sleep, and I know how. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulation. It has superior softness, unparalleled fabric, materials, and weave, has quality and longevity. All the products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. Cozy Earth bedding is built to last through the hardest days and the longest nights of parenthood. Incorporating Cozy Earth products into your sleep care routine, including their incredibly soft loungewear as well, can enhance your sleep quality and your overall wellness. Treat yourself to ultimate comfort with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear, and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. You deserve it. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use promo code MINDFUL35 for an exclusive 35% off. Soft as a mother's touch. Cozy Earth wishes you a happy Mother's Day.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and I think we bring a lot of stories, and we see this a lot in work with parents around, if I'm helping them calm their body, am I telling them they need to stop expressing? Like, am I trying to make this emotion stop and not letting them feel? And I think there needs to be a conversation around the nervous system regulation versus emotional regulation, and that they're different. When we're looking at those first four phases of emotion processing, we're looking at nervous system regulation. You are going to still feel afterwards. So you're going to have the emotion. If I'm feeling sad about something, me building awareness of that, like, brain hijack where I don't have access to my prefrontal cortex and I'm in that feelings part of my body and my brain, and regulating that so that I can regain access to my prefrontal cortex doesn't take the sad away. So after we calm our nervous system, after we calm our bodies, we'll still experience the feeling. And that's where I think, like, a lot of folks, there's, like, hang up around this of, A, am I, like, rushing the emotion away if I help them tune into their body and calm, if there's this emphasis on, like, feeling calm or feeling safe. But also then afterwards recognizing that, like, once they're calm, our work isn't done. Now they have access to their whole brain. Now they're in a space to do the emotion processing work. It's not just the nervous system regulation. It's then the emotional work around, all right, now you experienced this feeling. You experienced sad, or you were experiencing disappointment or embarrassment. And let's dive into that now. Now we go into that part. Does that make sense?
I think that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like you're saying, like, let's, you know, what the nervous system hijack leaves us no, like, cognitive, you know, no ability for sort of like the upper brain, for lack of a better word, to process everything. When we can, you know, get out of nervous system hijack, then we're able to then kind of process with our cognitive brain with those things. I mean, it's interesting. I would love to have someone like Lisa Feldman Barrett in on this conversation right now to say, because she talks about sort of that that graph with the different vectors of, like, you know, you know, intense, you know, feeling intensely and positive and versus negative affect of the feelings, and sort of like a lot of sensation versus like slowed down sensation. So it's interesting to think about that, because, like, in a way, like, the feelings are these terms, like these almost cognitive terms that we're putting on. We're going really deep into this. It's probably more than we need to go, but I think it's interesting. It's almost like these cognitive terms that we're putting on these these sensations, whereas you could just say, I have a really intense sensation and it's negative feeling, right? Like, it's interesting.
Yeah, it feels hard
to consider that.
Yeah, so, but I just think that, like, that's the biggest hang-up that we see in this work. And that I notice when people are trying to implement it, that, like, my kids are fighting over something and I step in and try and help them. I'm jumping to phase five problem solving. They're not ready for it, right? Like, everybody's dysregulated. But we jump in and we're like, okay, like, here, let's talk about it. You can, how does this feel? You can have a turn first and then you can go. And then they're still yelling at each other and nobody likes that suggestion and whatever. It's this ongoing mess of, because nobody's ready for that yet. And we jump to the emotion part of this, the emotional regulation, the trying to make the problem go away. And in actuality, I just want to shift back to, like back to the basics of acknowledging what's happening in their body, what they're feeling, supporting them with tools to calm their nervous system so that we can do that. Yes. And at first for kids, it's frustrating because they're like, no, solve my problem. Like, this is, I'm annoyed by this thing. And we go back to, I would love to help you when we're calm and ready. And so I'm going to walk through how to get to that point when you're ready. And there's no rush. You can be in it for as long as you need to, but we're not talking about conflict resolution or problem solving until we're there.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to help you when you're calm and ready. I mean, that's such a great phrase, dear listener, that you can grab right there from Alyssa. I love this. So in this age of 0 to 5, there's so much, you know, birth, we need, you know, we obviously, this is an essential task of that age for us to help be teaching. We have to practice it ourselves, right? Because we're going to get dysregulated. And then we have to help our kids regulate their nervous systems. We want to acknowledge and allow all those things. When we think about this age of 0 to 5, what are some of the things that, one of the things that I think is interesting, like we look at, a lot of us traditionally look at behavior, we look at, you know, bad behavior, misbehavior, but you know, we know that behavior is like an expression of needs, right? That kids are just trying to go about their lives, meeting their needs, and yeah, and they're like aggressive and messy and discombobulated and all of that stuff, right? But they're just basically trying to meet their needs. So what are some of the, like, the important needs that we need to consider that our kids may be having in these important ages of birth to 5?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to note that we call that stress behavior, misbehavior, etc., bad behavior. It, for me, means the nervous system is stressed in some capacity.
No, I think that's so important to think about, because people have asked, like, what is a stress response, right? Like, what is a fight, flight, or freeze stress response behavior versus when my child is trying to, like, deliberately push a boundary? And it's a really interesting thing to kind of consider, right? And most of the behaviors probably in the 0 to 5 are really just these, like, that we see as, like, these bad behaviors are, like, these stress response, fight, flight, or freeze behaviors. Although, I can't imagine, like, the moment, right, when your toddler, like, you know, you'll in a year you'll.
Oh, it already happens. He stares me in the face.
Stare you in the eyes.
Yeah,
let me see what happens. What will you do? Mm-hmm. Right then, that's pretty clearly like, okay, let me just like see, do an experiment on the world and see what happens right here. But
totally. So I will say, it's definitely, you're right, more common that we're seeing stress behaviors across the board, not even just 0 to 5. But again, if we're saying like, in order to deliberately do something, you have to be operating from a regulated state, which means you, self-control requires a regulated body. You're aware, you're regulated, you're making a conscious choice. That is not very common.
Yeah.
But when that is coming up, because, we are going to have times where, sure, they're regulated and they might be asking for connection. In that sense, where maybe they have nervous system regulation, but then they're saying, I'm feeling disconnected from you and I want to connect with you. And they never say that. Those words aren't coming up. They say that
Mother,
by going and like poking
like
their sister. Yeah. They say that by poking their sister in the face or whatever. Dumping out all the things, which is currently in our household, everything is dumped. And so it'll happen in behavior. Sometimes it's connection. And sometimes it is them saying, will you hold that boundary? Which for us means they're saying, are you going to keep me safe? Is it your job to keep me safe? And when we set boundaries and they push them, that's what they're asking, right? Like, who actually has the control here? Because if I have the control as a kid, that's truly overwhelming, and I will feel overwhelmed by that, even though I'm going to push to see, do I have it? And it is their job. It's our job to set the boundary. It's their job to push it. And it's their job to push it when we're sick, when we're traveling, when grandma's in town, when so-and-so's, when anything's different. It's their job to say, is this still the rule? Is this still the boundary? And I think so often what we want is obedience or compliance because that's convenient. We want to set a boundary and for kids to follow it. And I got to tell you, I've never in my life set boundaries for kids and had them be like, great, I can't wait to follow it. Like, that's not how it plays out.
Yeah, and it doesn't play out that way for adults most of the time either.
No.
Like, we don't learn something once and we're like, okay, got it, doom, doom, doom. Like, some things we do, but most things we need a lot of repetition for. Just, I think,
Or we need to know it's going to be held. Like, you think of the speed limit, and you know, like, how many people are like, okay, it says 30 miles an hour. I will do 30 on the nose. That's what I'm going to do. or I'm on the highway and it says 65, that's what I'm going to do, 65. If we knew, if you go over the speed limit, there's radar, you know, the signs say like radar enforced, and we know that's not real. If it was real and we knew, like, you're going to get a ticket sent to you if you go over that speed limit, people would most likely obey it more frequently. But because it's inconsistently enforced, that every once in a while you might drive by a cop and you're like, oh, now here comes the ticket. It, because you don't know when it's going to happen, it's worth taking the risk. It's worth seeing, is this the time that I can get away with it? With so many boundaries, when we're seeing inconsistency, it's worth it for children to say, is this the time where I'm going to be able to do this other thing, where I'm going to be able to get away with this? Or, and not in a manipulative sense, but in like a, I'm testing it, I'm learning. It's all trial and error for them to say, like, what happens when I do this? It's their first time in the world.
Yeah.
They're new here.
So, yeah. So I love that. I love that explanation. But so about to go back, like, connection, clearly, safety, clearly, some autonomy, right? Some sense of choice over some things.
Yeah, I want to see, like, do I have choice here? Am I in control of this? Yeah. Yeah, and when we're doing choice, we do choice theory. So we do two options, both of which, this is the kicker for adults, both of which are fine for them to choose. So yes, if I say, yes, I'm going to set a timer and in 5 minutes we're going to leave the house, if you want to put your shoes on by yourself, go ahead and put them on. When the timer beeps, if your shoes aren't on, then I'll put them on you. I'm not, when the timer beeps, angry at them that I'm putting their shoes on. That, like, that was a fine choice for them to make. They get to make one of these two choices. Both are acceptable. And then when I'm putting their shoes on for them, it doesn't mean it's like a trip to the spa either. They're not like, sure, put my shoes on me. But I'm not mad at them for choosing this option that I gave them.
That's a beautiful point. Alyssa, we have so much we could talk about. We could talk about this endlessly, but I want to respect your time. What did we have, you know, we talked about emotional processing. We talked about development. We talked about needs. Is there anything we missed that you want the listener to hold on to in this conversation?
Yeah, you're right. I could literally talk about this forever. Yes. Then I'm like, yes, we've missed so much. But no, I think, like, largely when we were doing the night that we got our book deal, my co-author and I were texting and about, like, all right, as we're going into writing this manuscript, what is that are like at the cornerstone of it? And when we were doing our research for the SEP method, the thing that was my favorite takeaway from it and the data that really, like, just warmed my heart was that kids didn't stop being kids. Kids had emotions, kids had emotional expressions, kids pushed boundaries. The adult experience of children is what shifted. The adult experience of a child's emotions or a child's boundary pushing, et cetera, is what shifted. And so back to the manuscript, that's what it came back to, is that what we want our impact to be around is the adult experience of children and their emotions and how they move through the world, to shift away from things like they're being manipulative or they're intentionally doing these things to drive me bonkers, into they want to feel connected and loved and worthy and seen, and they're using all the tools in their toolbox at this moment to do so.
Yeah. And it just takes the, it's not personal. It's not, no child is trying to get you. They're having a stress response. They're using their tools. They're just really undeveloped, wacky beings.
They're learning how to connect.
They're learning.
Right?
They're learning. Yeah.
They're learning. And we're learning with them.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure and a joy to talk to you. Where can people find out more about what you're doing?
Totally. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I could get nerdy with you forever. This is so fun for me. Folks can check us out at Seed and Sow. So seedandsow.org, seed and S-E-W, .org, or over on Instagram, seed.and.sow, S-E-W. Yeah, those are the two main hubs.
Yeah, Alyssa's Instagram handle is full of good nutriments to take in. If you want to be on social media, it's a great one to follow to take in some good inspiring stuff. Thank you so much, Alyssa. Thanks. This has been really a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I'm so glad that your little village had you carrying babies of 5 years old so you could end up sharing this all with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. This was so valuable, right? I mean, I got so much out of talking to Alyssa. I know you will too. And listen, if you love this episode, please do me a favor, share it on your Instagram stories and tag me there at Mindful Mama Mentor. You may as well follow me there and fill your feed with some mindful parenting inspiration. So I hope you loved this episode. I can't wait to be back again next week. I love doing the Mindful Mama podcast. I hope you love it too. If you want to support it, please, please leave a rating and review, share it around. We've grown to over 2 million downloads because of you. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate that. This is such an incredible community of people just working on that transformation to be part of the healing. It's awesome. And rock on for you for being here. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so glad I get to connect with you. And I wish you a great week. I'm doing some crazy stuff. I'm going to be traveling to Abu Dhabi. I'm going to be at Parenthood, the Unconference. I've never been on a plane ride that long in my life. So wish me luck and I'll let you know how it goes. I hope you have a great week and plenty of sleep and lots of moments of peace and calm and appreciation for this crazy, incredible life. So thank you so much for listening. Namaste.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.